We're having a discussion tomorrow on the permanent revolution, but it might have been better to have the discussion on the permanent revolution first and the discussion on Venezuela later, because everything I'm going to say is directly related to the permanent revolution. But I'll try not to say much of what Terry will say tomorrow. But what I will like to do is to recommend the comrades to read the statement of the IMT, of the International Marxist Tendency, that we put out in the summer last year, I think it was July or August, about the situation in Venezuela and the elections. Because I think it's really striking that everything we said there is now come to happen after the elections. And if you remember that document, we said that there were three main areas which needed to be resolved, or three main contradictions that needed to be resolved in order for the revolution to be victorious. We obviously recognize there is a revolution in Venezuela, a revolution is taking place, but this revolution has not been finished. And the three areas that we identified at that point that we thought needed to be sorted out, these contradictions needed to be resolved, was one, the question of the state apparatus, which is still to a large extent a capitalist state apparatus, the question of the economy, which is still a capitalist economy, and the question of revolutionary organization, which basically doesn't really exist in any meaningful sense. And within that, the question of revolutionary leadership, the question of a Marxist tendency, the question of revolutionary Marxist leadership for the movement. And we said as well that the elections in December, one, were not normal presidential elections in a normal country. They were an important battle between revolution and counter-revolution. And second, that the elections were seen by the masses as one point in which they will strike a blow against counter-revolution, but then they wanted the revolution to move forward. There was a building up of a mood of impatience, a mood of seeing that things are changing, but they're not changing fast enough, of seeing that how things are changing, but the counter-revolution is still in control of many things, the oligarchy is still in control of many things, there is impunity, people who participated directly in the coup have not been punished for that, and that far from the whole process moving to the right, as some sectarians were saying, they were saying the government is making agreements with capitalist owners of industry, the government is moving against the left wing of the Bolivarian movement and so on, that all the conditions were set for a sharp turn, for one more sharp turn to the left in the Bolivarian revolution. And this is exactly what happened in the run-up to the elections and immediately after the elections. As comrades know, the election campaign was quite bland, and the main line of Chavez for most of the election campaign was that revolution means love, and we should all love each other, and the revolution is not about violence, it's all about love, and it was really, really bland line, which didn't amuse anybody, by the way. This is obviously the advice of the reformists. Come election time, they basically say we have to moderate our language, we have to moderate our discourse, not to alienate the middle layers, the center ground in politics, and blah, blah, blah. And this obviously had a clear effect of not mobilizing the Bolivarian masses. That the people, on the one hand, they saw that the election had already been won. It was clear that Chavez was going to win the election. On the other hand, this election campaign didn't say much to them, and it was, and the counter-revolution was not seen as a clear and immediate danger. So for most of the election campaign, there was not much activity. And prior to that, there had been other warning signals, like for instance in the previous elections, which were council elections, there was massive abstention, low turnout, and there were discussions amongst the Bolivarian leadership, people around Chavez and so on, of why did that happen, and were people becoming disillusioned with the whole process, wasn't going fast enough. But then something happened 10 days before the elections that changed the whole situation. The opposition managed to have a big demonstration of maybe 1, 2, 3, or even maybe 400,000 people in Caracas. And then masses saw that as a clear danger, that the counter-revolution was gathering forces, was gathering strength, and that decisive response should be given to this. So there was a demonstration the following weekend, the last Sunday before the actual elections, and this demonstration was probably the largest amongst the largest demonstrations that have taken place during the whole of the revolutionary process. About 2 million people participated. The whole of Caracas was collapsed. It wasn't in fact a demonstration, but a giant rally. And one comrade, Francisco Rivero, was reporting how he tried to go from Valencia, which is like 5 hours drive or 3-4 hours drive, to the capital, and couldn't reach the capital. All the roads were blocked, and inside Caracas everything was blocked. It was a massive demonstration just before the elections in which the Bolivarian masses came out on the streets. And also at that time there was another significant thing that happened, that this coalition was set up of rank and file Bolivarian groups called Oligarcas Temblat, Tremble You Oligarchs, and it was basically an attempt to organize the rank and file in revolutionary mobilization for the elections, that is to block any attempt of a counter-revolution to come out in the streets and say that the elections have not been legitimate and so on. So all these pressures were building up in the run-up to the election, and then the election day was really something. It was like in August 2004 during the recall referendum. It was like in December 2002 in the struggle against sabotage of the economy, and it was like in April 2002 in the struggle against the coup. The ordinary masses of working people, Bolivarian masses, came out in the streets and delivered a decisive blow against counter-revolution. One, on the election results. The election results were really impressive. If you think about this, Chavez got approximately 3 million extra votes on what he had already gotten in 1998. That means that he went from something like 3 million votes to 7.5 million, 3,300,000 to 7,400,000, something like this. And a massive increase in the number of votes on a bigger electoral register, but also on an increased participation, increased percentage of votes for Chavez. In many states around the country, like in Apure, in Portuguesa, in Barinas, in the rural areas and in the Chavista strongholds, Chavez got more than 80% of the vote. I mean, it is difficult to find anywhere in at any time in history a revolution which has been legitimized in elections, in normal bourgeois elections, with so such a massive majority. And the revolution that is Chavez won, even in Zulia state, which is the only one of only two states ruled now by the opposition, where the opposition candidate is the governor. So that was also an important victory. And it was done on the basis of this, of the revolutionary mobilization of people in the streets. But it was not only a question of the election, as I say, it was a question of revolutionary mobilization in the streets. And the comrades who were there from the Hands of Venezuela delegation, and the comrades who were there from the CMR, our comrades in Venezuela, they reported that from 2 in the morning, people were sounding horns and sirens in the working class neighborhoods in Caracas for people to come out and start queuing outside the polling booths, which will not open for another 5 or 6 hours. And you see the masses of people outside. This is not a normal election from the point of view of the masses, and it was certainly not a normal election from our point of view. You know that in the statement that we issued in August last year, we said we appeal for a vote for Chavez. And the sectarians obviously criticized us for that. And even we had a discussion with our former Turkish comrades who have a basically sectarian position in relation to the Venezuelan Revolution. They said there is no need to call for a vote for Chavez. Chavez is going to win the election anyway. What is the point in taking a position? You're basically supporting a bourgeois candidate in the election. So it's completely wrong. If we had had that position, we would have been cut off completely from the real movement of the masses. So from 60, 70, 80% of the people in many cases who saw voting for Chavez as the way of delivering a blow against counter-revolution. Not voting for a bourgeois candidate or anything like that. Not voting for love and peace. They were voting against the counter-revolution and for the revolution to move forward. And this was expressed most clearly In the demonstration of the National Peasant Front, Ezekiel Zamora, they had a demonstration of about 20,000 people just before the election, and their slogans were quite clear. Vote for Chavez, fight for socialism, against war to the latifundia, war to the oligarchy, war to capitalism. This was the mood that existed amongst the Bolivarian masses, with which we were able to connect because we had the right slogans. So as I say, on election day, the Bolivarian masses physically prevented the counter-revolution from attempting any tricks. Anywhere where they set up opposition barricades, they tried to create chaos and disruption in the streets, the Bolivarian masses came out and physically disbanded this riot. By early in the afternoon, the leadership of the opposition had to come out on television and admit their defeat. Which they didn't intend to do originally. They intended not to recognize their defeat and say the elections had been fraudulent and not clean and transparent. They couldn't do it. They realized, some more intelligent sections like Teodoro Petkov and Manuel Rosales and others, social democratic counter-revolutionaries, they realized that had they done that at that particular time, then there would have been a real tidal wave of the revolution. People would have taken over the property of the oligarchy and so on. They would have lost more than they could have won. And they calculated, okay, during this election campaign we have managed to increase our support, show our possibility of mobilizing people in the streets, which they had not been able to do since 2002 when they were defeated in that kind of numbers. And therefore, we have to build on this. We have to build on this, patiently wait for better times, gather our forces, not to squander what we have achieved. So that was their tactics. Immediately after the elections, what happened was that the reformists within the Bolivarian movement said the following line. They said, the opposition has recognized the result of the elections. This is very good. It proves their democratic credentials. We now have a democratic opposition, not a coup-plotting opposition. And therefore we should talk to them. And also remember, 30 to 40% of the people still voted for the opposition, so we must include them in any talks about constitutional reform. There was even an idea on the part of the reformists in the Bolivarian movement to invite the opposition to be part of the National Assembly, of which they are not part because they boycotted the elections 2 years ago in December 2005. But the mood was not that amongst the rank and file, and Chavez, who is always very sensitive to the mood coming from the rank and file and tries to encourage this mood as well, he picked up on that. And he said, one, there's no negotiation with the opposition. If they want to be in the National Assembly, they can stand in the next elections in 2008. And as everybody else, they'll have a chance to put their proposals to the vote of the public. And he immediately, just days after the election, set on a course of radicalizing the revolution. Contrary to what the sectarians had been saying, that the revolution was moving to the right, that the government was moving to the right, making agreements with the capitalists, he immediately, even from election night, made it clear what the new stage was going to be about. If you've seen or read reports about election night victory speech, he came out on what is called the People's Balcony, People's Victory Balcony, in the presidential palace and in front of a mass of people under the rain. He said, this is a victory for socialism. He said, long live the socialist revolution, long live the Bolivarian revolution. This is a victory for socialism. People have not voted for Chavez, they have voted for socialism. So that was quite clear in the mind of Chavez. It was quite clear in the minds of the masses as well. They had not voted for peace and love, they had voted for socialism. Meaning what? Meaning the radicalization of the revolution. Shortly after that, he announced the setting up of the new Socialist United Party of Venezuela, about which I will talk more later. And this was seen by Chavez and by the masses as a clear attempt to deliver a blow to the bureaucracy of all the Bolivarian parties and to set up an organization based on rank and file democracy. Then just weeks into the new period in January, just after the Christmas holidays, he made a speech swearing in his new cabinet, which has been reported to the Congress, in which he appointed a minister from the Communist Party for the first time in the history of Venezuela. Now, this minister is not particularly radical, and the Communist Party's leadership policies in the Venezuelan Revolution are rubbish. But the appointing of a Communist Party minister, making a big thing out of that, means, look, communism is all right. Communism is part of this revolution. That's what is meant by that gesture, and the emphasis that was put on this one measure. And then he appointed a Trotskyist minister, who is in reality not a Trotskyist, must make this clear, and is someone who really has an anti-working class policy. Well, not so much an anti-working class policy, that's an exaggeration, but it has a policy against the against nationalizations, against workers' control, and it's introducing a whole number of really bad measures in the trade union movement. In the context of the revolution, it's not an open counter-revolutionist, but it's a reformist within the movement. But nevertheless, the point is that Chavez appointed a Trotskyist minister, and he made a big thing about that, recommended people to read Trotsky, and he said, I am also a Trotskyist, I follow the line of permanent revolution, about which Terry will say a few things tomorrow. So, he then talked about the five engines of the revolution, and they produced this thing. This has been officially produced in Venezuela. There are there are hundreds of thousands of these little leaflets produced by the Ministry of Communication and Information, distributed around the country. These are the lines of the new government. And it's called All Engines Full Speed, or All Engines Full Revolution, plain words. We're going towards socialism. Now, what are the five engines of this? Because this is quite interesting. In order to understand what stage are we at in the Bolivarian Revolution. Now, the first one is the enabling law. Enabling law means giving Chavez full power on a whole number of things. Now, this has been heavily criticized, both by bourgeois public opinion, but also by the sectarians, who say, well, this is a move towards dictatorship, and there's Stalinist tendencies in the Bolivarian Revolution showing up. But in Venezuela, people think precisely the opposite. It's really very good that Chavez has full power over these things, because he is the only one who can deliver on these things. We want delivery on. You know, he's the only one who's going to do it, rather than all these ministers who we don't particularly trust. And then this is another funny thing. The Bolivarian officials have tried to justify this decision by saying, well, this is in the constitution, which is true, and it's also only for a limited period of time, but this limited period of time is 18 months, and it's only on a limited number of areas of policy. But these areas of policy, if you read them, it's everything. It's the economy, national defense, strategic things. And so what did Chavez do with his enabling powers? Well, he immediately announced the nationalization of CanTV and Electricidad de Caracas, CanTV being a privatized telecoms company in the hands of a U.S. multinational, and Electricidad de Caracas being the electricity generator and distributor for the central area in Caracas, which was also privatized, and was in the hands of a multinational, can't remember from which country. Not only this, you could see how he was really impatient that these things should be done immediately, and he went for a week's tour to South America. He was in Brazil and other countries immediately after he announced this measure. When he came back, he said, well, why is this not being carried out yet? I mean, I announced this nationalization, I come back 1 week later, it's not being carried out yet. This is not a thing for the next few months, this must be carried out now. And I instruct, and he did this on live television, he got on the phone with the Minister of Communication, and he said, we want this nationalized immediately, we want a new director's board appointed now by the government, and we'll discuss the compensation later. Now, there's been a big discussion about these nationalizations, because these have been nationalizations with compensation. That is, it's not been an outright expropriation. And these people have been bought off, basically, the foreign multinationals, at market prices. There's only one small detail, that when the expropriations were announced, market prices collapsed. So the state was able to buy off the shares of this Verizon and other international groups at quite a reasonable price. Now, our argument is that there should have been no nationalization. What they should have done is there should have been no compensation. What they should have done is what Allende did when he nationalized copper in Chile, which is to say, these companies used to belong to the state. They were sold for X amount of money. These private companies have invested X amount of money in the 10 or 15 years they control this, and they have extracted so much profit. Therefore, if you add up all these figures, there's no case for compensation. They've already been compensated many times. This is what we will have argued. You can't be crazy ultra-left about this in the sense of saying, no, no compensation is a principle. Okay, no compensation is a principle, but you need to explain it in a way that the masses can understand it. And if the figures have been produced, we've seen the figures, they justify a policy of no compensation. Nevertheless, they've been compensated. Now, the sectarians use this to shout, well, this is not really nationalization, this is not really progressive, it's just state capitalism, but they don't understand anything. The signal that is sent is quite clear to multinational companies that your investments here are not safe, and you don't know what's going to happen next. And international companies have picked up on this message very, very clearly. And I'll give you one figure which I only discovered this morning, if I can find it. Oh yes, here it is. It says here, this is figures from the central bank. The central bank in Venezuela is still dominated by the opposition, so any economic figures in Venezuela you have to take with a pinch of salt because they are used for political purposes. But it says here that if you compare foreign direct investment in the first quarter of 2006 with foreign direct investment in the first quarter of 2007, that is after the announcement of nationalization was made, it has gone down by 92%. So it means that there's no foreign direct investment anymore in Venezuela. Foreign investors are not investing in Venezuela after the elections, because they can see something that sectarians cannot see, that there is a revolution in Venezuela, there is a push towards state ownership of strategic sectors of the economy, and that the state is quite serious about this, even if it's with compensation. Okay, fair enough, there is compensation, but still you're not going to invest in a country where you don't know what's going to happen the day after, you know, even if you're compensated for your original investment. So this is one. The second one is the reform of the constitution, that's here, so that we have socialist legality, basically. That's what it meant. And I was reading now today, this reform of the constitution is now coming into discussion. I was reading today some of the measures that have been proposed, because Chavez said the problem with the constitution, which was voted and discussed in 1999, is that at that time there were many infiltrated agents of capitalism, he said that in his words, capitalism and the oligarchy inside the constitutional assembly. And many things went in that we don't particularly want. There were representatives of the banks in the Constituent Assembly, he said, and they made sure that certain articles say certain things. And so we now have to bring these articles in line with the socialist character of the revolution, which was not the case in 1999. This is quite interesting, to say the very least. So now, for instance, they are now going to have an article in the Constitution that will allow for expropriation. The article, the draft that's been used now, it says that if the Republic considers it necessary to take over entire branches of production in order to guarantee food security, this is an important point because there's a campaign of sabotage of the food distribution chain, in order to guarantee food security, these activities, private activities, will be allowed to be transferred to government bodies or social organizations. Social organizations. This means that included in this is the possibility of giving this to cooperatives of producers, giving this to workers' control, and so on. And the state will have full powers for expropriation and confiscation. In these cases, will now be contemplated in the Constitution. So you can see where the thinking is in relation to the constitutional reform, and the capitalists are raising a big hue and cry over this constitutional reform, quite rightly. The third one is called morality and enlightenment, something like this, which means the education of the people with socialist values. And included in this is a new measure by the Ministry of Labor, which puts into law the fact that workers in factories will have factory councils, will be created. The competences of this or the tasks of these factory councils are not very clearly discussed, but it is not workers' control. But, I mean, in a situation like Venezuela, it could very rapidly develop into workers' control. The workers set up factory council, and they want to know what's happening in the factory. They want to know why they're not being paid proper wages, why the factory is running at only 60% capacity, and things like this, you know. But one of the things that this factory council will be able to do is to use, I think it's about 3 hours a week working time, paid working time, for political discussions. To have socialist education of the workers. Because the idea that is coming from the reformist wing of the movement is that the workers are not prepared for workers' control because they don't have a high enough level of consciousness. This idea is obviously rubbish, but the measure that they have put in order to solve this is quite good. The workers will be able to meet during working time and discuss about socialist principles. And just to let you know, a couple of our comrades have been appointed to carry out this task one in Guayana and the other one in Caracas. Two comrades, one is a member of the Central Committee and the other one is a comrade from Guayana, the main industrial state for basic industries. So the possibilities are really open, and you can see them, the direction the movement is going. The fourth one is a bit more obscure. It's called the New Geometry of Power. The socialist reorganization of the geopolitics of the nation. But what this basically means is that the countries will have a more evenly distributed model of economic development, rather than having everybody living in Caracas and Maracaibo and Valencia, and then the rest of the country is mostly empty. So what they've done, for instance, is that they've now started what's called Steel City. This is a massive new development. This is a new city they're going to build in a place where only 10,000 people live. They want to bring up to 100,000 people. There's going to be some steel industries put in there, and then some infrastructure, transport, and so on. This is one example. And then they are bringing in new transport links. For instance, Venezuela is now the only country apart from China where the development of three major new massive public transportation systems in three different cities. They're building metro systems, underground transportation systems in three major cities. They have built two new bridges over the Orinoco River at the cost of $1 billion each. There's massive investment in infrastructure everywhere. And this is the only, by the way, this is the only engine of the Venezuelan economy, public investment. Public investment has gone up, if you can find the figure, from one-third of GDP, it's gone up from one-quarter of the GDP in the 1990s to one-third of the GDP now, which is about $180 billion a year of public investment in public works, massive infrastructure works, and so on. I mean, this fourth engine of the revolution is not a major thing from a Marxist point of view, but we as Marxists, we will also like to see a more even development of the country, you know. The fact that now the government is investing in development of railway lines is quite telling of the parasitical nature of the Venezuelan oligarchy. Railways were never developed in Venezuela, or were only developed at a very small scale, because in 1910 they discovered oil. You don't need railways to transport oil outside of the country. And this is a big jump. And this is what the oligarchy and imperialism were interested in Venezuela. That is to transport oil out of the country. That's the only thing. Therefore, they don't need railways. This is a clear example of the theory of permanent revolution, which says that the bourgeoisie in backward countries is not in the epoch of imperialism is not able to develop the country. And Venezuela is a country that has not been developed from any point of view. The fifth engine is the explosion of communal power, which means the following, which means that for now 6 or 9 months, communal councils have been set up. These organizations in the neighborhoods that organize about 200-300 families. They meet in general assemblies, they elect their spokespersons, and the idea is to give them power over issues pertaining to that community, that is, whether X repairs must be made, whether Y number of houses have to be built in that community, what are the main needs of that community. The state is going to give them resources directly so that they can do it. This is an attempt, if you see, this is a strange attempt to bypass this main problem that we mentioned before. The fact that the state apparatus is still a capitalist state apparatus. So they want to build something else. They're discussing these issues, you know. They probably don't have a clear idea how to do it, the people who are in the leadership, but they are groping in one way or another towards this direction, that we need a new revolutionary state institutions based on this communal power. And Chavez said that this community council must be then linked up at the local, regional, or national level to form a new state apparatus. And what he said about this is really interesting. It's been published and distributed in hundreds of thousands of copies. What he said is, progressively, we, the constituted power, we must transfer all power, political, social, economic, and administrative, to the communal power. That is, to this new power based on community councils, so that we move towards a state based on social needs, and we do away with the old structures, and this is now Chavez's direct quote, all of this is quote, the old structures of the bourgeois capitalist state. I mean, Chavez had never said a thing like this. He'd always talked about the Fourth Republic, the state of the Fourth Republic, the old state of the Fourth Republic, the old bureaucracy of the Fourth Republic. He's now talking about the bourgeois capitalist state. Bourgeois capitalist state, which all it does is to put a brake on the revolutionary impulse of the masses. And he added in another speech that the old capitalist state has always been the tool of domination of one class over another. So you can see he's been reading, and you can see what he's been reading. Now, that doesn't solve the problem of the state apparatus. What do we say about the state apparatus in Venezuela? What we say is the following. We say that the state apparatus is still a capitalist state apparatus. In what sense? In the sense that both the personnel, that is the people who occupy these positions in state institutions, are basically the same, though obviously revolutionaries have been grafted onto it in the different ministries and different positions, and also in the sense of its structures and its aims. This is the same structure, hierarchical, top-down structure, not under the control of ordinary working people, that has served the interests of the ruling class for 200 years. This state apparatus has been perfected. Its personnel has been trained in serving the interests of the oligarchy, the interests of capitalism. However, this is not a normal state apparatus. In what sense? I mean, Allen has said in some articles, this is a polemical formulation, that the capitalist class doesn't have control over the capitalist state anymore. And this is quite true. If you look at it, the capitalist class, that's the oligarchy, cannot at this particular time use the state apparatus, which is basically capitalist state apparatus, against the revolution at this particular time in an open battle. That is, they cannot organize a military coup, they cannot use the police to defend private property in the way they would like to do it, and so the state is paralyzed by class struggle, and at the same time its strength is diminished, it cannot be used, but it's still a capitalist state, and this we must insist. This is important particularly, and the comments were writing about this recently, in relation to the army and the police. Incidentally, in relation to the police, there is now an idea that has been floated by Chavez, that the all police forces must be disbanded, and they must be set up again as a national police force rather than a municipal police force, must be set up as a national police force under the control of the community councils. Well, I would say this is our program as well. When we discuss the question of police in advanced capitalist countries, we have said the police must be under the control of working class organizations and under the control of the communities, the neighborhood tenants associations and so on, must be under the control of the working people. In relation to the army, what is the situation? The army has been largely purged of its most reactionary elements that came out at the time of the coup, but it's still a capitalist army. There's a top-down chain of command, and politics are not officially allowed inside the army. People cannot get organized. Army officers or soldiers cannot be members of the new Socialist United Party up until now. This might change, though. And it's still a capitalist army. However, the capitalist army has been largely part of its more reactionary elements. But that doesn't mean, like many people say in the Bolivarian movement and leadership, that the army is with the people. The top army officers are loyal to Chavez. But there's nothing to say that when and if Chavez says, moves towards full-scale nationalization of the economy, that is towards socialism, there's a big clash over this, that these military officers will follow Chavez. They might or they might not. It depends on also on their own calculation of the risk involved. If they see that this is not going the right direction, this is going to cause massive chaos, it's going to be military intervention from outside and this, that and the other, they might choose not to follow this path. And recently, military officers were arrested on charges of sedition, distributing leaflets against the government, organizing plots against the government, and so on. But there is also a thinking in relation to this, and measures have been put in place that if they were applied, they will go a large extent into dissolving the capitalist army and creating a workers' militia. These measures are twofold. One is the creation of the expansion of the reserve force of the army. These people who have done the military service, they are now back into the reserve force, organized in military units and receiving military training on a regular basis. Quite a lot of this has been happening, and they wanted to include 1 to 2 million people in the reserve force of the army. This didn't really take off very much. It happened to a large extent around the country, but it's not consolidated. So then they came up with this new idea of the Territorial Guard. Territorial Guard is more like a militia system, like the Committee for the Defense of the Revolution and the militia system that exists in Cuba. And it's basically people in every neighborhood, in every block of flats, in every house, organized in military units, platoons, regiments, and so on, receiving military training, having a cache of arms somewhere that they can get hold of in case of emergency, and being organized and receiving military training. And this is not only for people who have been already in the military service, but for everybody. Women, young people, men, everybody can be included in this territorial guard. Now, if you look at this, this is an excellent and you couldn't find better chance to set up a legal workers' militia. It's nothing to say that workers in one factory cannot say, okay, we want to have a territorial guard, we're going to have a socialist battalion here in this factory, and we go to the military barracks and we demand the military training. And in the current conditions in Venezuela, this will be encouraged by the people who are at the top of this reserve guard and probably will receive military training. What is the obstacle? The obstacle is the obstacle that I will talk about later on. The lack of a clear leadership of the workers' movement. This is what is holding the whole process back. Because nobody has taken this up. None of the 5 different factions of the UNT have taken this up in a serious way. In the places where this has been talked about, or promoted or proposed, there's been massive reaction on the part of the people and on the part of the workers. In the basic industries, steel, aluminum and all these things in Guyana, the trade union leaders, the Bolivarian trade union leaders, they went around the workers and they asked for people to sign up to be part of the reserve of the army, and people signed up. They're just waiting for military training to be given to them, you know, and they're prepared to defend the factories, defend the neighborhoods against counter-revolution. And now Chavez has said that the military policy or the military, the policy of the military in Venezuela is now going to change. They're going to have a much more reduced army combined with a militia system. And the militia system will be the people in arms, he said, in order to fight against foreign intervention, against imperialism. So that's the thinking in relation to the army. If these measures were actually implemented and if there was a workers' organization pushing this forward, you will have, in a matter of small scale of time, a workers' militia, the dissolution of the army. This should be combined, the communists are saying, with obviously political discussion inside the army, the linking up of the workers' organizations with the rank and file soldiers and revolutionary officers, and political organizations being allowed inside the army so that further dissolution of the chain of command is affected, and that an alternative system is started to be created on the basis of this. And I was talking about communal power and the question of the state. This is a contradiction in relation to the state. Now, in relation to the economy, what is the situation that we have in Venezuela? It's a very peculiar situation, because on the one hand, Venezuelan economy is strongly based on the state. That is, the state controls the oil industry and therefore controls a large part of the economy. Everything revolves around this. And the situation that we have now is a typical situation where in any place where reformists come to power and they try to put limits to the normal working of the capitalist system. Because Chavez has talked about socialism and so on, but it's not very clear what he means about by socialism. It's just moving, taking different measures and advancing like this. There is a rumor circulating that there was actually a sixth engine of the movement towards socialism, and this was dropped in the end. And this sixth engine was about the economy, which, as you can see, is not mentioned here, really, in any clear way. Now, it's also handier to have five engines, because it's a five-pointed star. But there was a sixth engine, and the sixth engine was the socialist economy. And the rumor, which has been told to us by Michael Leibowitz, who is well-connected in Goldman circles in Venezuela, is that the reason why Chavez dropped this was because he didn't think he was going to get much response from the key ministries involved in the economy. That is, the Ministry of Labor, Ministry of Basic Industries and Mining, and the Ministry of Oil, and the Ministry of Finances. These four ministries are dominated by the right wing of the government, and they are against workers' control in strategic industries, and they are against nationalizations outside of what they consider strategic industries, that is electricity, telecoms, and stuff like that. So they are the right wing, and therefore this was dropped to be discussed later on. And this discussion is starting now. Chavez has said that we need planning of the economy. But the small detail is that you can't plan the economy, as we've always said. If you don't control the economy, you don't own the economy, you can't really plan it. So the situation is like this, that the government has introduced a whole number of regulations and barriers and brakes and controls over the normal working of the capitalist system to make the economy more favorable to working people. This is quite a long list of rules and regulations in this economy. For instance, there is control of food prices. There is, that is, the food prices are fixed by the government for a whole large number of basic foodstuffs. And companies cannot sell over this, supermarkets cannot sell over these prices, although they do in many cases, but that's another story. There is control of foreign exchange. That is, companies cannot take money out of the country, cannot buy dollars for purchasing things from abroad without permission from the government. And the government has said, for instance, in relation to food, has said that private companies will not be allowed to import food if that food could be produced in Venezuela. So basically they're trying to solve a problem that does exist, but they're trying to solve it by putting artificial barriers on the normal functioning of the capitalist system, which means two things. It means, one, that the capitalist system doesn't work to solve the normal necessities of the Venezuelan economy, and two, that the capitalists don't want to play with these rules of the game. And therefore there is an investment strike, and there is a flight of capital, even with these foreign exchange controls, which, and there's always ways around foreign exchange control. And now they have one, which we're not going to go into any detail because it's a bit complicated, but it does exist. There's control over the prices of rent in for housing in Caracas and other main cities. The rents have been frozen for, I don't know, 2 or 3 years. There is also a law which was passed at the time of the economic sabotage that says that companies cannot make workers redundant. This is not necessarily implemented, but the law is there. The workers are legally protected by law. They cannot be made redundant anywhere in the country for the last 3 years. Imagine that. There's also control over interest rates. Interest rates are fixed by the government and the banks, and there's also a number of regulations over the working of the banks. The banks have to dedicate, I think it's a third of the lending, how do you call it, the lending basket or the lending, the total amount of money they lend, one third has to be on terms determined by the government, that is in towards micro lending for small producers, for cooperatives and so on, at terms that are very favorable to these people, very low interest rates, long terms of repayment, no possibility of taking over property when there is no non-payment and stuff like that. So this is what is happening, and this means, as in any case where reformist government tries to control the working of the capitalist market, that the capitalists don't like this, and they're basically sabotaging the economy. If you look at the Venezuelan economy, what the capitalists are doing is the following. The Venezuelan economy is now the fastest growing economy in Latin America and one of the fastest growing economies in the world. I'm not totally sure what's the figure for growth last year, but it was something like 12%. This year is expected to be 7.6%, something like this. It's a big rate of growth, but it's based on government investment. And the government is invading the foreign reserves of the country, which the capitalists are complaining about, in order to put all this massive amount of money into the economy. And so now the economy is booming. And what is the effect of the economy booming? To reveal all the contradictions of the Venezuelan economy to a massive scale. That is, now people have more money in their pockets, they are spending more. I've got some figures here, for instance, for the increase. What is this? The increase in food consumption, for instance, from last year to this year, 30%. People are buying more, people are consuming more, but the market cannot provide for this. So this creates an insoluble contradiction in which then the government has to import food from abroad. For instance, Venezuela imports 90% of all cooking oil that it consumes, imports large amounts of meat, large amounts of chicken, even eggs, basic products like this, maize, lots of different things they have to, sugar, they have to import from abroad, that is paying hard currency, and then sell at subsidized prices in the local market. It doesn't make any sense from a capitalist point of view. And this is also partly the result of the deliberate sabotage of the food distribution chain on the part of the capitalists. I've seen many examples of this. Sugar mills that refuse to process sugar because on the one part of political motivated sabotage, but also because these sugar producers, they don't think it's worth refining sugarcane when then they have to sell at these fixed prices from which they reckon they cannot make a reasonable profit. So they basically abandon this. Now the government in the last month has nationalized two meat processing plants to slaughterhouses. One of them was, when it was functioning, one of the largest slaughterhouses anywhere in Latin America. And up until last year it was slaughtering about 100 animals every day, 800 to 1,000 animals every day. And then it was left idle. It was abandoned by its owners. What did the workers do? After a while they took it over, and now the government has nationalized it, and it's going to be run under some form of workers' participation and so on. But this is just one indication of what is happening in the food distribution chain. That is hoarding, speculation, sabotage, and so on. And there is only one solution to this. The one solution to this is the nationalization, wholesale nationalization of the food distribution chain to be run democratically under the plan, democratic plan of the economy, run by the producers, these small agricultural producers, the cooperatives and so on, the workers who work in these different parts of the food distribution chain, and the consumers, which are working class people in the working class neighborhood. There is no other solution to this. And the government is already hinting in this direction. A few months ago, they passed a new law, which is called the Law on the Law Against Hoarding and Sabotage of the Food Distribution Chain, which allows the government to expropriate anybody who is involved in these illegal activities. And the Minister of Agriculture said clearly, they said, if you organize a food strike, we'll take you over. It's quite clear where the classes are going in that direction, all the pressures are going in that direction. The National Peasant Front, Ezequiel Zamora, which is probably the most advanced leadership of the Bolivarian Revolution anywhere, apart from our own tendency, they have now decided, this is the largest peasant organization in the country. And it's run by people who consider themselves Marxists. And they have come, two of them, or the leading people, national leadership, went to the CMR Congress, which was, after all, only a congress of about 50 or 60 people of a very small organization. But they have gone there, and they have said the reason why they are there is because they want to learn how to occupy factories and run them under workers' control. And they have now decided to send a permanent representative from their leadership to the leadership of FRETECO, the Revolutionary Front of Occupied Factories, which our comrades have organized, and they, in order to learn how to occupy factories and collaborate with workers in occupying parts of the food distribution chain, that is sugar mills, maize mills, slaughterhouses, and dairy processing plants, everything. So, because they can see that this is the only way forward against sabotage. And they, together with the other organizations involved in the Oligarchas Temblat coalition at the time of the elections, just a few weeks ago, they occupied the central headquarters of Fede Cámaras, the main business confederation, under the slogan of, if you take away our food, we'll take away your factories. This is a peasant organization. It's not, not anybody in the workers' movement is doing that. The Congress is saying that if the workers' movement in Venezuela had 10% of the leadership that the peasant movement has in Venezuela, things will be much much different. So this is what is happening in relation to the economy. Chavez has threatened to nationalize the banks, threatened to nationalize Sidor, the steel plant in Guyana. And this is quite serious because the banks are mainly dominated by foreign multinationals. Two Spanish multinational banks control quite a large part of the banking sector. Sidor is owned by an Argentinian multinational. So this, if he was to nationalize Sidor, it will put him in a collision course with Kirchner, which is one of his main political supports in Latin America, or the one that he's been grooming as his main political support in Latin America, together with all Bolivia and Ecuador and so on. But you see, sectarians do not understand anything, because what has happened now is this, that the government has reached an agreement with Sidor. What the government said to Sidor is basically the permanent revolution theory. The government said to Sidor, this steel plant, they said, this is not on. You process Venezuelan steel ore and make steel. So the steel, the basic product is Venezuelan. Then you make steel, you sell it in the world market, at world market prices, and then it's sold to a company in China, and then this is processed and manufactured into steel products, machinery and other stuff, and then it's bought by Venezuela for this development projects, for these infrastructure projects, at world market prices. So the government said, this is not on. Plus, you're getting cheap electricity, which is produced by the state. You're getting tax exemptions from the state. You're getting all this stuff from the state. So basically, this is a very good business for you, and we don't like it. What we want is this Venezuelan steel to be sold to Venezuelan companies at cheaper prices than the world market, so that Venezuela can develop. The Venezuelan economy can develop. And this is the context in which he made these comments. And the same thing in relation to the banks. He said, it is not on that the banks have all this money, which is Venezuelan money after all, and they are not giving cheap loans for the development of Venezuela's industry. And therefore, if you don't do it, we'll expropriate you. Now, the banks will rather negotiate rather than be expropriated, obviously, and so is CIDOR. So now an agreement has been signed with CIDOR, which includes a clause that says that CIDOR's not going to be expropriated, but it's going to be selling these products at the national market, this and the other. It will have to include two workers elected from the workers themselves, not from the unions or from anybody else, from the workers' assembly themselves into the administration board so that they can check the working of CIDOR and that this agreement is carried out. And so an agreement has been reached, and now all talk of expropriation of CIDOR has been dropped. So the sectarians are now already shouting, okay, look, I mean, this is your socialism. Government is making agreements with these private companies. There's not going to be any expropriation. This is all a farce. It's just raising the red flag to scare them off and then getting good terms of agreement with the capitalists. This is all the government is about. But what they don't understand is this basic fact, that there is a revolution in Venezuela. That when Chavez announced the threat of nationalization of CIDOR, the workers in CIDOR came out on strike, 9,000 of them, and they blockaded illegal, unofficial, spontaneous walkout. They blockaded all the roads, and they raised the Venezuelan flag over the factory, which now has obviously a factory company flag. And they said, we want full expropriation, we want full nationalization. The workers, even after the agreement, are not happy with this agreement, and they will continue fighting for expropriation. And what will happen, probably, is that at some point down the line, 1 month, 2 months, 1 year, or whatever, there will be another conflict between the workers in CIDOR and the management in CIDOR, between the management in CIDOR and the government over this agreement, and then they will be nationalized. This is the direction things are going towards. This is not certain, but this is a likely course of events. All forces are pushing in that direction, that is, further sabotage on the part of the capitalists, further action on the part of the government to expropriate. And this will in turn should have increased the activity of the workers' movement, which it has, but not to the extent it could have happened because of the lack of clear leadership on the part of the workers leadership. And now the last point, and probably most important point, is the question of the revolutionary organization that we pointed out in that statement that we issued about 1 year ago, and that Chavez took up in the form of the formation of the Socialist United Party. Now the sectarians are also jumping up and down. This is a multi-class party, it's a bourgeois party, and it's this, that, and the other. It's a popular front party, and employers and businessmen asked to join, and so on. And yes, it is true. When Chavez made the appeal for the new party, and when Chavez has been talking about the economy, he says, private economy has a place in the Venezuelan economy as long as they are dedicated to the development of the country's economy in the benefit of the majority of the people and in favor of the interest of the communities and the workers. Now, this is not going to happen. So therefore, it is quite likely that they will come to realize that private economy has no place in this new so-called socialist economy. It's the same thing for employers being or not members, or businessmen being or not members of the new Socialist United Party. Now, Chavez has invited them, and there's even an organization being set up called Socialist Employers, Socialist Empresarios Socialistas por Venezuela, and it includes a whole number of businessmen who support the Bolivarian project within certain limits, including, for instance, the owner of Ron Santa Teresa, one of the best rum brands in Venezuela. So anyway, but if you look at the meeting when they had the swearing-in of the promoters of the party, that is the party cadres, they're going to go out there and recruit people, you look at the people who were there, and there were no employers, no capitalists there. There were ordinary working people from the lowest ranks of the working class, the most oppressed sections that have been brought up into political life now, and if you listen to the swearing they made, and this was a long oath they took, because Chavez likes to talk for a long time, and probably thought, well, do like two or three lines oath, and then he got excited, and this was like for 5 minutes, a full stadium of 17,000 people were repeating this oath. After Chavez said one sentence, they repeated the sentence. with the hands raised or the fists clenched, and they swore to build a party for socialism, to build a socialist Venezuela. It was quite clear what it meant in the minds of these 17,000 people who are now out there setting up the party. And if I was a capitalist, I wouldn't particularly like to be in this meeting or anywhere near this party. But this will be an open struggle in the next few months. Who takes control over the party, the reformist wing of the movement, or the revolutionary rank and file? The capitalists will want to have an in this party, particularly the leading layers. But it's not very clear what's going to happen with the party, but what's happened so far is this. They had a target of registering 3 million people. And I thought at the time this was an exaggerated aim. At the time of 2004 recall referendum, 2 million people participated in the, how we call the electoral platoons that were set up at that time to fight the electoral battle. At the time of the Bolivarian circles, 1.5 million people were members of the Bolivarian circles. And now they were going for 3 million people to register for the party. Well, you know how many people they registered? 5.6 million people registered for the party. They are not members yet, but these people who gone, there has been tables set up outside metro stations, outside factories, in communities, in villages and so on. People have gone there and they registered to join the party. In fact, this means that two-thirds of everybody who voted for Chavez in the elections are now registered to be part of this new party. In some places, like in Alto Apure, which is one of the most militant regions from a peasant point of view, more people have registered for Chavez's party than people voted for Chavez in the election. And this can be explained, I think, by the fact that people under 18 have also registered for the party, and people who are not on the electoral actual register have registered for Chavez's party, and so on. It is also true, some people have said, that there's been trickery in some places, that is, a local bureaucrat registers a whole bunch of people who are with him or under his political patronage in order to have a parcel of power in this party. But I would say that this is not the dominant factor. When you get 5.6 million people registering to be part of this party, this is a genuine mass movement of the people wanting to be part of this socialist party. Now, you tell me another country in history where such a thing has happened at such a scale. I mean, it's difficult to imagine. And what they're going to do is on the 21st of July, there's going to be the first meetings of the local branches, which are going to be called the Socialist Battalions, composed of 200-300 people. And they're going to have a series of three meetings, like three branch meetings, to discuss politics, basic politics, basic socialist politics. And then they're going to elect delegates to a national congress. And we were doing the math the other day with Rob, and on the 21st of July, there's going to be, I think they said, 21,000 such meetings. 21,000, is it 21,000? Yeah, 21,000 such meetings, or 20,000 such meetings, at 200 people each, that's 4 or 5 million people. And Chavez will go to his own one in central Caracas, part of the process, meaning that he is clearly sending this signal that this must be a rank and file party, that the rank and file must elect the leadership, must elect the delegates to the Congress, and then there's going to be a Congress with about, I think it's 2,000 or 3,000 delegates, and this Congress is going to be in session for 3 months. That's what they said so far. I mean, you know, in Venezuela things are going to happen as they come along. But it means that the delegates will meet, will discuss, they will go back to the branches, they will discuss, they will go back to the Congress, they will discuss for a period of 3 months. And then the party's program and constitution will be put to a referendum, national referendum of all members. The amount of real democracy that you can have in a mass process like this is obviously limited. And we know, for instance, in the Cuban Revolution, they also had meetings of 1 million people, and Castro put to the vote, the first declaration of Havana was put to the vote. But what could people do? Could they present amendments? No, they could just vote yes or no. This is going to be, to a large extent, a similar process, but I will say with more democracy, because if there's branch meetings, people can discuss things, they can move resolutions, they can move amendments, they can go to the Congress, where probably most of this will be ignored. These Congresses will be more like big rallies and so on, but it will be nevertheless a process of mass political discussion that's going to take place over the next few months. And still, you have some sectarians who have chosen to stay outside of this, including Well, the pity is that some important leaders of the UND have chosen to stay out, like Chirino. And I will say the main reason for this is not even sectarianism, it's just personal pride. Because Chavez attacked him publicly, now he doesn't want to join the party. Well, that is what, really, because the overwhelming majority of workers who followed Chirino on his militant stance on trade union questions and on the revolution will be part of the new party, and they will be involved in the new party. And that will be Chirino's contradiction, not the contradiction of the movement. So this is, I'm already gone over time, so my last point is this. I had some other figures on the economy which are interesting, but my last point is this, that this is probably the weakest point of the Venezuelan revolution, the leadership of the working class movement. The UNT is divided in five different factions, and they are all fighting over different things that have nothing to do with the main interests of the workers. The sectarians, they concentrate on two issues. One, wage increases, which is not the main thing you should be fighting for in the middle of the revolution. You can still fight for wage increases, but you should be fighting for workers' control in a situation which is extremely favorable for introducing all sorts of forms of workers' control, factory occupations, and so on. They have actually resisted taking any measures in relation to factory occupations when the general trend of the working class is towards that. Just 2 days ago, there was a factory occupation in a factory that makes, how do you call the insides of the tires for the cars? The inner tubes of, for the cars. This is an auto part plant in Valencia. It's been occupied by the workers because the workers suspected that the factory was being run under capacity, and there was an attempt to declare it bankrupt and get rid of the workers. They occupied it. This is about 700 workers in the main industrial plant in Valencia. They occupied it, and they are running it under workers' control, against the advice of the sectarians who have control of the trade union movement in this region. And the other point they're concentrating on is autonomy, trade union autonomy. This is important to discuss because the comrades will come up with this argument in discussions with other people in the movement. And they say, we must defend the sacred principle of trade union autonomy. Trade unions must be independent from the state, independent from political parties, independent from the bosses. This is fair enough principle, which is in the history of the Venezuelan trade union movement. But just a second, we are in the middle of a revolution. Are you saying that the trade union should be independent from the Socialist Party? That the trade union should be independent from this government? No, the trade union should be pushing the left wing of this government forward against the right wing of this government. They should be taking a clear political position. And Chavez quite rightly criticized them. This is really funny. He used quotes from Rosa Luxemburg, from a book that's been published by the Spanish Communists that he got somehow, and he used this to say it is counter-revolutionary to think that trade unions should not be involved in politics. All those who argue for autonomy of the trade unions are counter-revolutionary, putting forward a counter-revolutionary position. Obviously, Chirinos got a bit upset about this, and he interpreted this in the following way. The government wants to have control over the trade unions because it doesn't want an independent trade union movement fighting for the interests of the workers, because the government is making alliances with the capitalists and wants to have the labor movement under control. It's completely crazy. Trade union autonomy is not an issue in this particular time in Venezuela. What should be an issue is that the trade unions fighting for workers' control, fighting for socialism, taking over factories, starting to organize a network of factory councils and pushing the whole process forward, which is not happening. And this is a real weakness of the Venezuelan revolution, which we, with our limited forces, are trying to sort out with the setting up of the FETECO, the Revolutionary Front of Occupied Factories. And now, as comrades probably know, one of our comrades, Jorge Paredes, who's the president of one of these occupied factories, which runs and the workers' control, it's run by our comrades, who have now, I think it's about 20 workers in the factory out of the 78 workers are members of the organization. We have two branches inside the factory. We're running this factory, and he's been invited to a meeting of the cabinet. That is a meeting of an enlarged meeting of the cabinet, the meeting of all the ministers, all the presidents of state-owned main companies, to discuss about how to set up a socialist economy. And obviously our comrades had something to say about this, and others had other ideas, and now the comrades have presented a proposal of what a socialist company should be. And this is based word by word in on Lenin's decree on workers' control in 1917. It's now being discussed. But this is just an example, just so that you know what kind of discussions are taking place at the top level in Venezuela. So this is not a government that's making agreements with the capitalists trying to control the revolution within the limits of capitalism. It's a government that doesn't know what to do, wants to go forward, but in a very confused way. Now, there is a danger implicit in this situation. You cannot make a revolution halfway, as we've said many times. You cannot disorganize the capitalist economy without replacing it by a planned, democratically planned economy, which is what is happening now. But these are, I would say, the main forces that are implied in this, and all the different factors are pushing towards a major clash in the next period, and it's just a question of whether revolutionary leadership will be built in time to take advantage of this or not. Otherwise, we could go towards towards an abolition of capitalism in Venezuela without a Marxist leadership being present, as it happened in the case of the Cuban revolution.